Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hornaday.
Hey there.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
And Chris Casso.
Hello.
How is everybody this fine evening?
I think we're starting to get to the bleary point again.
Yeah.
It's a little late here in the Emerald City. It's a little late.
So it'll be a good podcast.
Yay. Wait
over these hot microphones for you people.
Wait
you ungrateful people.
Hey, that assumptions.
I'm conscious.
Now that we've alienated everybody who's listening, let's start
talking. One person in the corner there. Yeah, you. I'm looking at you. Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Put down your iPod.
Was that a reference to Bill Murray at the end of Scrooged? All right. Have you not seen Scrooged? The movie Scrooged?
Please.
All right. So at the very end, he's like, oh, you in the back. You who's been talking throughout the entire movie.
Sure.
Let's talk about technology since we've already mentioned iPods. So what I like about comic books is that, you know, the beauty of it lies in the simple medium being able to tell complex stories. But we as a species are undergoing this transformation where technology is informing more and more of our lives. And I've already seen examples of, like, comic books that aren't quite cartoons, but the panels are alive. And it's not a web comic either.
It's like the AR stuff where you put your phone over a panel and starts animating.
It's that kind of thing, but I think it's going to get even as bendable paper becomes more of a thing. Mm. And it's already a thing. It's just how long it takes to get to the consumer market. When do comic books fundamentally change, and will they ever? And so I want to put this question out to the group. Like, where do you see the industry in 50 years?
So I think there's a good chance that things will go, the mainstream part of the market will shift more digital, and then you can have things changing quite a bit on that front and evolving. But no matter what, there will always be a contingent that says, screw this paper. Mm-hmm. So you will actually get a divergence, and comics will still be comics, but you'll have a whole new thing that's not comics maybe evolve from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a good comparison on that.
Well, I think a lot about how, you know, for centuries, people have been saying theater is dead, and yet we still have live theater. Ben and I met through doing live theater. I think there's going to be an analog with comic books, is that there will be this digital, perhaps virtual aspect of it, but there will always be the paper. And maybe it'll be more of a fringy thing, maybe it'll be more of an underground thing, but one will inform the other and continue to do so the way theater informs other mediums of entertainment. In the writing, in the storytelling modes, and the ideas that are being challenged. That's my theory.
Yeah.
I like that theory. It's a very pleasant theory because it keeps both things buoyant in my heart. But, you know, you guys can shoot down my balloon. It's all right.
You said, oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
You said virtual, and that's that actually just sparked, because I've played a bunch of virtual games in the, why am I blacking out on what they're called? Those headsets that you can buy
virtual
and take
reality.
Home now. There's a specific brand.
Cheeseburgers.
There's a specific brand, and I can't think of what it's called.
Oh, Oculus Rift?
Oculus Rift and all that stuff, yeah. And it wouldn't surprise me if at some point some of these publishers just decide to create Oculus Rift games that are just comics instead of, you know, like the next step up for somebody like a Lion Forge or a Valiant would be like, here's an entire issue that you experience from the point of view, and you have to move in this 3D world to move the plot forward. Something like that.
Pretty much like a Telltale, or what people really dumbly refer to as walking simulators. Things like Gone Home and Rapture, Welcome to Rapture, and things like that are kind of point and click versions of these ways to tell stories, but they're interactive and in an immersive sense.
Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be the key difference, and what's going to lead to my next question for you guys is that, because I'm thinking about what components will stay. You know, will there always be a hand-drawn aspect of it? Will there be an artist at a board of some nature at a pad of some nature, drawing, constructing images from their brain through their hands into that. But then, is it going to be a single point A to point B to point C linear story, or is it going to be more like a video games where it's complete reality where there are multiple options for pursuing a story?
Sandbox.
Yeah. Yeah. I see that the comic book is going to continue on in some form or fashion, that it will be panel to panel work,
okay,
in the sequential art, yeah, style that we know now.
Yeah.
But it may take on a digital perspective, or it may take on other transmedia aspects, like maybe a VR version where you, yeah, can walk through it, or
uh-huh,
or something like I've mentioned a long time ago in a podcast far, far away, that it was Bee and Puppy Cat, where you would use a QR code to hear the little like music box that was, uh-huh, playing in the comic. Mm-hmm. You know, those interactive things, or the AR thing where you scroll over it. You know, it's going to have some sort of other media interaction.
Mm-hmm.
But even like a web comic, I forget which web comic it was that you, Chris, had told me about, but it was something where you had to scroll down and the comic, as you went, like there's no way you could really print it.
Emily Carroll, I think.
It's kind of, yeah, it was, yeah, like an endless scroll, like a physical paper scroll, but online, where, mm-hmm, you read the comic going down.
Mm-hmm. Here's the weird thing. So that's there's two different things that could have been that you're thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is about to be brought to print.
How?
They're going to figure out a way
to scroll versions.
They're gonna chop it up, yeah.
Or maybe you read it sideways or something like that.
Yeah. So I guess there's always a way to find a print.
But it might lose something,
yeah,
by being in that print.
I think it will.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it can also transform into something else uniquely different.
True.
I just thought that as technology advances and makes our life more difficult and complicated, it also makes it easier. And when self-driving cars become a thing, and driving your own car one of these days may become illegal unless you have like a special license, people will have more time to read comic books on their commute.
Mm-hmm. It'll be like a Tony Stark technology where we'll just have like a holographic image of like in front of us, and we'll use our fingers to like scroll through the pages.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
I think that if we want to go all like Philip K. Dick on this, I think the future of comics, they will still be static images, mm-hmm, on what might be paper, what might not be, but it's all going to be rights controlled, and, mm-hmm, it will scan your retina, and only your eyeballs can read this comic, and it can trace where you're looking on the page for whatever reason.
And also, one day you will read a comic and realize that you live within the Matrix.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. Like Philip K. Dick predicted.
Mm-hmm. I think along with that, there will be... what we'll see first is probably an evolution in how some of the rights and copyrights play out.
Mm.
And you'll get more open source material, because that's actually, I'm not going to say a trend, but people are experimenting with it now.
Yeah.
There's an open source comic called Something and Carrot. Help me.
Pepper?
Pepper and Carrot. And
it's very cute.
It's very cute. Beautiful. And the creator made it with the express purpose of being freely shared. You can publish it anywhere, you just have to give credit.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to pay to do it.
Right.
So more stuff like that will start to happen. And at some point, Marvel, DC, and a few of these others might have to get to the point where they'll have to get ahead of some of their copyright stuff and make Superman kind of open source. You know, like you can still do anything with it. You can publish anything with it, but we hold the rights to publish anything with that will make money.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. But if you get an idea and you use it, that idea becomes ours.
Mm-hmm.
We can redo that any way we want. But, you know, we don't sue you for doing it with our character.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of what I was trying to say in the second episode of The Panel Jumper about Octobriana, was that I saw her as this old school open source character. And, you know, that was part of my motivation for doing that episode, was like, I want to see if I can push people to do this.
To pick it up.
I see it happening.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it has not yet. But maybe when Ben and I are long gone, the world has moved on, someone will be inspired.
I think, though, to your previous point, Cole, about are there going to be people sitting at boards, drawing. I think that is going to die off with those particular kinds of artists, because I think the creation of comic books is just going to become easier and easier. That the time it takes to you, for you to sit down and draw something, sketch something out, have somebody else ink it, have somebody color it, the weeks or months it takes to produce a comic book is going to be so outdated, it might be laughable for the people who work in current tech and like, oh, we can produce a comic, you know, in about 2 days now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll see, because I wasn't necessarily referring to, paper and ink, but there's, I don't know, I studied graphic design for a while. I never had started working with a Wacom tablet. I didn't start working with a pad. But, and any artists out there can chime in, can come back to me on this, because I know that Gene Ha goes back and forth from print, doing things manually to digitally. But for me, even with my limited experience of doing graphics and drawing, there's a great deal of satisfaction to hold a pen or pencil in your hand and see that it's primal. Yeah. It's like cave painting. And there's a great deal of satisfaction of putting that on a piece of paper.
There's something satisfying about reality.
Wait, what?
You know, crafting and things like that. Something that you make with your own hands. Something that you use tools.
Do you agree? I think it's a very primal pleasure response that you are doing something with your hands. And I'm a little dubious that's going to be entirely lost. I think artists are going to keep wanting to come back to that.
I'm wondering how long it's going to be until the first comic created by AI will hit the stands.
I didn't know it hasn't already.
I feel that'll be actually an anime first, because there's a current trend of animes having nothing but like CG art in them, and I hate them so much. And so it'll be the machines that do that to me first.
Yeah,
absolutely. They'll be like, these things are pleasing. Let's put it all together and make a story. Mm-hmm. That's my AI voice, by the way.
Hello, Karen.
Turn left here.
Hello, Karen.
Turn left in 500 feet. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to be, because I'm sitting in the middle of a comic book store talking to two people whose livelihood depends on the retail aspects. But I'm like, in 50 years, I think we will look back and say, man, remember that time when we had entire stores devoted to that?
I think there will be a day that we do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I still think that there is something to the paper aspect. And I think the people who like to come to stores, they like probably the community aspect, but they also like paper. I mean, I've had people who say like, yeah, I'll read digital, but it's different, you know? And I think I'll go the way of digital when there is something that like really works really well to read comics on. Like at best we have tablets, but I don't have one of those.
Yeah.
And it's not readily available to me. So it's really not appealing. And reading anything on my laptop is just atrocious, and I never, ever want to do it.
20 years from now, somebody's going to be in VR reading a comic inside VR.
Yes, yes.
And then we can end as a species.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is when we close the chapter on human.
That's another interesting, is if we're forward thinking, you know, you have your comic book. It's just a white blank, you know, book. But in your glasses, that's where the information is. So it knows as you're reading, it prints pages on it.
Yeah.
There you go. All right. Yeah. This is getting kind of depressing.
Copyright that right now.
No. Hey, it's on the podcast. Copyright as of November 20th, 2017 for episode 145. We've been doing 145 of these things.
How long have we been doing this?
A long time.
145 All right. episodes.
145 episodes.
Years wise.
It's like two and a half, three
months.
Yeah. 3 months.
When is my contract up?
All right.
Oh, you didn't sign one? I don't think you realize that.
Keep going, Ben.
So if you are, we live here in Seattle, and I'd like to think that we're a pretty nerdy, geeky city. And if you're planning on coming and visiting our fair city,
don't.
And you want to... Well, it's don't
save your money.
Don't tell Cole you're coming.
Yeah, no, there's no room for you here.
And you want to do a little bit of comics tourism? No, so I put this question out to the panel. I'm like, if I'm visiting town and I want to just like see some cool places, like, you know, like for instance, if I was big into the grunge rock music scene, I would want to see like where Pearl Jam's rehearsal space was in Pioneer Square, the house Kurt Cobain shot himself in. Even though it's kind of morbid, it's actually a destination for people like that.
It's not that far from here either.
So, and I've seen it. So
Crocodile Cafe.
And then the Crocodile Cafe.
Sure.
So comics tourism. If I'm coming to Seattle, what should I take time out to go see?
All the lovely comic book stores.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's plenty of adventures to go up and down I-5. Mm-hmm. And just go check out different stores. I mean, that could be its own field trip.
There's the Dreaming, there's Xanadu, there's Golden Age Collectibles, which Arcane. Is a very old store. There's Arcane. There is, I'm going to forget their name, Outsider? Mm-hmm.
There's Outsider in Fremont, which is a boutique and comic book store. It's right. got so a lot of
stuff. We have
cool
Geek Boutiques.
We have Geek Boutiques.
Yeah.
You should check out Push Pull down in Ballard. It is kind of an art gallery feel to it. Mm-hmm. They carry a lot of local zines and support local creators. They have classes of different types and meetups with different creators, including David Lasky, who was on a live episode of Panel Jumper. I have to separate these in my head.
Both start with P.
Yes. And then we have a lot of different events. There's, of course, Emerald City Comic Con, but also we have ICAF, which unfortunately we just passed as of this recording when this airs, but it's the International Comic Art Forum, and they have lots of great guests, and it's where educators and artists kind of meet up and do all sorts of stuff. And then there's also right after that the Short Run, which is a comics and art festival, which also just finished before this podcast got out, but so
look them up if you're planning on coming to Seattle next fall.
There's comic book conventions in some form or fashion that happen throughout the year in the surrounding area. Whether you like independent stuff or you like mainstream stuff or you want to get back issues of something, like there's always some sort of convention or class or something happening.
Yeah. There's also MoPop, which is the old EMP sci-fi museum. They're trying to rebrand, but it'll always be the EMP to me.
Yeah.
Also, during Bumbershoot, they have sort of geeky, nerdy things that you should check out if you go to Bumbershoot. Of course, Bumbershoot costs like $75 a day to get into. So if you just happen to be there, then check out Flatstock, which is like a poster emporium.
There's a pretty active gaming communities in Seattle too, and there's you can always go to Card Kingdom and Cafe Mox, and you know, tournaments and stuff like that are always happening.
Up on Capitol Hill, Raygun Cafe. What's that place called?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Raygun Cafe.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's the Gamma Games. That's all tabletop stuff too. Yeah. I believe. Yeah.
There's also a couple of escape rooms in Seattle. I don't know where they are or if they are any fun, but I've heard.
I've heard they're fun. Yeah, I've heard good things. I don't know where they are.
Yeah.
And so look up escape room.
There you go.
And we're so helpful here.
We do, I know. Look at all that research.
You all got Google.
Didn't do. Yeah. We also have a local publisher, Fantagraphics.
Yep.
And they're a really cool place to check out down in the Georgetown area. And there's a record store and bars and all kinds of stuff around there.
They have lots of signings there, too.
They have signings. Yeah. They have a lot of interesting, like, local art.
Art galleries.
Yeah. And they're a half music store, half comic book. So if you like both of those things, they're definitely a destination.
Cool. There's also an organization in town called Geeks Who Drink, who do pub trivia nights that Cole and I actually got caught at one one night when we were trying to have a meeting.
That's an understatement. We always get caught at trivia night when we're trying to have a meeting.
Fool me once. Yeah. Shame on you.
And you know what it is? Because we try to meet on Wednesday nights.
Yeah.
That's where we fail. We need to stop doing that.
We have a favorite bar and they're like, Wednesdays at 8 is where geeks who drink trivia is at our favorite bar.
And man, those people are territorial.
Anyway,
we're territorial.
If you have something comics related in Seattle that you think should be included in this list we're compiling here, email it to us at perfectbombpodcast@gmail.com. Now, friends, let's move on to book report. And let's start with you, Cole Hornaday. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I have a suggestion for you, Ben. At some point, I think we should do like a Holy Grail episode. The books that you've been looking for a very long time, for whatever reason. They are hard to come by. They are scarce. They had low print run.
Your white whales?
I like that better, yeah. So I finally got my hand on one of my white whales, which is, and I'm going to share a little bit about it with you, just because I learned some things. So back in 1992-3, novelist Bruce Wagner and illustrator Julian Allen had a serialized comic strip in Details magazine, and it was called Wild Palms. And eventually, Oliver Stone adapted Wild Palms as a miniseries. You know, and back in 1993, that was kind of a big deal because they had a big name film director making a miniseries that was not an ongoing series. So it's this. It's the story of a gentleman, he's an attorney named Harry Wyckoff, and Harry gets caught up in this organization that is sort of running Hollywood. They're working on new types of filmmaking, something called New Reality, but they're also working with this drug that's called, let me back up a bit, because I'm kind of conflating the plot of the graphic novel with the plot of the TV series. But there's an organization that is kind of a very thinly veiled and sometimes not so thinly veiled reference to Scientology. It's a fascinating book. What is interesting about reading the graphic novel is Julian Allen's artwork is very photorealistic. In fact, I think there are frequently times where he is drawing directly off of photographs, and they are done in very tight, Dave Gibbons-style grids, sometimes 9, sometimes more. But the thing to remember about this, the Wild Palm serialization, is that there are only 2 pages per issue through the course of like a year, I believe. And in fact, in the comic book or in the graphic novel, there's still the little triangle on the corner that it designated it as the comic books as opposed to fashion, movie reviews, and things like that. And there's also frequently the indicia, what do you call it? The fine prints? Indicia?
Indicia?
Yeah, yeah, I got it right? Okay, I always feel like I'm saying something indecent. So this story must have been incredibly frustrating to read month to month.
Yeah.
Because the graphic novel story of Wild Palms is incredibly non-linear. In fact, by the time you get to the end and Wyckoff is on all these, he's on these drugs that have a long-term effect, and he's going in and out of these psychedelic states. His wife changes who she is frequently. He's seeing people as animals. The organization sort of starting to run the world has got their feelers into everything. And after a while, the graphic novel starts to feel like a William S. Burroughs book. And I've only had the misfortune of trudging through one Burroughs book because it was this kind of fragmented psychedelic reality where in chunks it was really interesting and intriguing, but in a linear story it was really infuriating to try to read. I thoroughly enjoyed reading Wild Palms. I'm really glad I tracked it down. By the by, it took me over 10 years to find it because it's actually really expensive. I got this copy from a dealer in Australia. It cost me more to ship it than it did to buy the book.
Wow.
But in the States, it's like 50, 60, 70 bucks to find a graphic novel.
Wow.
Collection in good shape. And you can still actually get the TV series, the network TV series on DVD, I believe, because it was relatively groundbreaking at the time, but people kind of conflated it with Twin Peaks because of the weirdness aspect of it.
Yeah.
Both stories end on a tragic note, but the TV series definitely has a more linear aspect because it was made for network television. And it has a very concise beginning, middle, and end. The graphic novel does too, but there are lots of loose tendrils and loose ends. I'm really glad I got it. I think it was worth hunting down my great white whale. I wish I could give you a better description of what happens in the story. I think I was anticipating it to be more of a damning examination of Scientology and that culture. But it's really not. Particularly the graphic novel is more about the nature of Hollywood and this... and this blurring of realities and what is real and what is not and what is entertaining and why do we do these crazy things? Is it all for money? Is it all for power? It's all terribly confusing. Oh, and drugs.
Mm-hmm. And also drugs.
Yeah.
It definitely has that rotoscoped look on all the panels there. All right.
Very cool illustration.
And there are tons of references. Like Carrie Fisher is actually a character in the story.
Really?
So it really does mess with your sense of reality. I mean, she comes in, she interacts with Harry. So there are celebrity characters, Ray Bradbury, you know.
All right.
So, yeah.
Wild Palms.
It's trippy.
Thank you, Captain Ahab. Let's move on to Nicole. What do you want to tell us about?
So I read the fairly new, as of this recording, Redneck Volume 1. It's another one of those glorious Image trades, though it does not have that gateway price. It's actually priced at $16.99. And this is a redneck vampire story, kind of like Interview with a Vampire, but if it happened in Texas. And it's written by Donnie Cates. Of course, names that are I'm going to butcher. Lisandro Etherin and D. Kunif. Knife. I don't know. Sorry, guys. I'm terrible at this. So it happens in East Texas, and it's following this quote-unquote family of vampires that have had this long-standing battle with the Landry family, who are humans, going way back to the time of the Alamo, things like that. And there's two different guys. One he's called Uncle, what is it, Bartlett or Barrett? No, I can't remember. But anyway, the uncle who kind of, he kind of made himself be a part of this family when he was made by who knows who. And he's always had a differing view from the father of the family, the patriarch of the family. The patriarch is like, let's just do our own thing. Like, we'll have a cattle ranch in the middle of nowhere and we'll drink the blood of the cattle and we won't, like, interfere with humans and we'll just do our thing. Mm-hmm. And the uncle is a little bit more, like, unhinged. Not, like, completely, but he's just a little bit more rebellious, you know? And he's like, I want to go into town and do things, you know, whatever. So he kind of does his own thing. And the young boys of the family, who are kind of like a... they would be the equivalent of like early 20s, but they're like 60 years old or something like that. They decide to go off and have a good time in the city, and something goes awry and they wake up in the morning like vampires do and find that one of the sons is like hanging in a tree and he's been killed and all the cattle are wiped out. And so it becomes this like, you know, whodunit sort of mystery. And things take an interesting turn and you get a bit of history on the family and like who died when and who was involved with who and stuff like that. And it's very interesting. It's a cool spin on the vampire tales that we've heard tons of vampire tales. So I haven't read a ton of them. So it's still pretty fresh for me. And it had this art style that kind of reminded me a little bit of like a Temple Smith, just because like in the faces and like the emotions and stuff, it's a lot less muddy, you know, there's actual backgrounds and things like that. Though I do love Temple Smith for what he does. There's also an elder of the family who's like grandpa and he's like hiding in the attic and he's got his own view. Like he's like, you know, remember when vampires had a spine and we just did whatever we wanted to do. Like there's a line in here where it's like, you know, if we didn't know like who to kill or who to target, we just like killed everybody. You know, this is sort of the through line of it. So yeah, it's interesting. It's very violent. I feel like if you want to have like a vampire twist of something like maybe Southern Bastards, because it's kind of got that like spit and venom, you know, a little bit. It's pretty interesting. I'd say check it out. I'm definitely curious to see how things go because there's some twists and turns Yeah. So Redneck, I definitely Volume 1, Deep in the Heart. Definitely recommend it.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Excellent.
A twist. What's a twist?
Thank you, Nicole.
Yep.
And finally, Chris Cassell, what do you got for us, sir?
I read Planetoid Praxis. This is the second in the series of Planetoid. I already reviewed the first issue here at one point, and after I read that, I was like, wait, I know the whole series is good. I'm going to wait till it's done. Ken Guerin is the writer and the artist. He's just solid. I love his art style, and he's great at sci-fi and world building. You do not have to read the original series to enjoy this, although it does enhance it. This takes place years after the events of the first story, and all these different aliens who have gathered and come together on this prison planet that's very hostile and kind of techno-organic, they've created little communities, and they've had children, and they're trying to make the most out of their life on this crappy planet. And one day they suddenly notice that there's like new people with technology that works. And it turns out that the war that was the reason that they were all landed on this horrible planet has been long over for like a decade, and nobody bothered to come and get them. Yeah. And their sector of the this galaxy was sold to a corporation, and this corporation is just setting up shop, and the corporation is like, yeah, you know, we'll recognize you legally if you fill out all this paperwork and do all this stuff. And they're like, well, no, get away from us. We can take care of ourselves. And it's such a great reflection of how corporations can be so horrible, because there's this whole segment where suddenly these little ships fly over their settlement and block out the sun. They pull a Mr. Burns, and they actually receive a billing statement for usage of the sun. And it turns out that the corporation now owns that sun. It's like fun little things like that as these people are just
so fun
trying to survive. And there's a range of different characters. There's like a family, and each of the different children have their own paths and storylines. Some people are finding that there's like a secret history to this planet before the war and all that stuff. Some people just want to get off the planet. There's the whole corporate story. So there's just lots of great stuff in here, including short stories by the creator that he did before he ever touched Planetoid 6 or 7 years back. So I highly recommend this if you just want good sci-fi. It always puts me in mind of great 80s sci-fi movies like Enemy Mine and Last Starfighter and stuff like that. There's like this nice chunk of socio-political stuff happening, and just well told. So it is only $16.99. Both volumes are currently available.
Cool.
Excellent.
Planetoid Praxis. Thank you, Chris. Well, that is Book Report, and that is our show. And coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, where you can also buy tickets to The Panel Jumper Live. And what is that date, Cole?
December 8th.
December 8th here in beautiful downtown Fremont, west of Lennon. As well as the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or however you get your podcast at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Now, friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. This week, our questions come to us from Mr. Cole Hornaday. Lay it on us, Cole.
Well, welcome to Quiz Time. This Quiz Time, this Perfect Bound podcast Quiz Time, is called Dancing on the Head of a Pin, a quiz time devoted to angels in comics.
Ooh.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Hope so. Some of this is going to be a little wordy. Please forgive me. Jim Corrigan was a hard-boiled cop who, after being murdered by underworld thugs, was transformed by supernatural powers into an undead spirit of vengeance, who was also a superhero, throughout the Golden Age and Silver Age. However, when writer John Ostrander got his hands on the character in the 1990s, he transformed the character into a repentant fallen angel and the embodiment of the wrath of God.
Spectre.
The Spectre. Spectre was originally created by Jerry Siegel, co-creator of Superman, and Bernard Bailey. First appeared in More Fun Comics number 51 in 1940. Now, here's a character whose publishing history is far more interesting to me than the character itself. I-M-O, in my own opinion. She first appeared as a supporting antagonist in Todd McFarlane's creator-owned series, Spawn, as an angelic bounty hunter out to bring down that friendly neighborhood cadaver. However, when the character's co-creator, Neil Gaiman, disputed the use of the character and the lack of residuals from comics to action figures to film rights, McFarlane claimed the character was not co-owned, but created under a work-for-hire contract. McFarlane had also refused to pay Gaiman for the volumes of Gaiman's work that McFarlane published and republished and kept in print. See, this is why whenever I find an opportunity, you guys. Do not get me started on the hypocrisy found herein. The lawsuit ensued, and following the settlement, Gaiman took sole ownership of this character and spirited her to the Marvel Universe. Who the hell am I talking about?
Angela!
She first appeared in Spawn number 9 in 1993 and later in Marvel's Age of Ultron number 10 in 2013. Okay.
He like dug her up and then just flung her towards like Marvel corporate. He was like, all right, good, that's done, whatever. Just fling her corpse over there.
Am I not mistaken that he does not, even though he owns the character, he doesn't collect any money on her? It all goes to charity now?
I would assume, but I don't know.
Yeah. And I forgot all that falderall that
It's a whole thing.
It's messy.
It just made me mad to reread it.
Yeah.
Now, this character was originally a guardian angel who served heaven for millions of years. He willingly fell to Earth and became a superhero. Joining the Justice League, he helped to dispel the forces of the renegade angel Asmodel.
Zariel. Before you even started, I was just going to scream Zariel at the beginning of the entire quiz time.
Zariel actually had an action figure in the Total Justice line. He was created by Grant Morrison. Well, actually, not really Morrison, but put to better use by Morrison. Mark Millar and Howard Porter, and first appeared in JLA number 6 in 1996. Now, following the Nightfall storyline, in which Bane left Batman paralyzed, a new and vicious protector of Gotham City rose. He was mentally programmed by a secret religious cult known as the Order of Saint Dumas and named after the Islamic Angel of Death. Anybody?
Azrael. Ruining Detective Comics since months ago. All right, anyway.
Azrael.
The first Azrael was Jean-Claude Vallée. I always say Valley, but it's Valley, I think. First appeared in Batman, Sword of Azrael, 1995. But there was a second one, right? There was someone who took over after Jean-Claude.
I didn't read those.
Oh, okay.
I don't know nothing about it.
Okay. Finally, in Neil Gaiman's Sandman story arc, Season of the Mists, Lucifer abdicated the throne of Hell, leaving the Lord of Dreams the keys to the Infernal Kingdom. Gods, demons, and fairies from all over creation descended upon the Dream Realm to lobby for Inferno's ownership. Morpheus eventually hands the keys to Hell over to these two angels. Anybody? Anybody?
Anybody?
Bueller.
I knew this was going to be a hard one, but it was Duma and Remiel. Duma and Remiel initiate a new regime of punishment meant to redeem the condemned, while Lucifer opens a nightclub and inspires the creation of a really lame network TV series. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Cole, and thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.